This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series.
Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Scribe, and we are delighted to be talking to Kate Ryan about her debut novel, The Golden Book. Kate Ryan writes fiction and non-fiction, and her work has appeared in publications including New Australian Writing, The Sleeper's Almanac, Mianjin, Kill Your Darlings, The Griffith Review, and Best Australian Stories. Her picture books were published by Penguin and Lothian. She won the Writers' Prize in the 2015 Melbourne Prize for Literature and the novella category in the 2017 Lord Mayor's Creative Writing Awards. Her work has been recognised in others, including the Josephine Ulrich, Calibre, Elizabeth Jolly and Burundara Awards. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
The Golden Book is your debut novel. Can you give us the elevator pitch? What is it about?
It's about a woman in her late 40s, Ali, who learns of the death of her childhood best friend, Jessie. And they had a very kind of intense but conflictual relationship. And when they were 12, nearly 13, Jessie had a devastating accident, terrible accident, which took place at Mumbala Creek Falls, which is a beautiful waterhole near Bega on the south coast of New South Wales. So it's kind of about the fallout from the accident, the ripple effects through both their lives, and also about the intensity of their friendship and everything that that led to.
I want to come back to that theme of friendship. But first, when did you know that you wanted to write this story and how did you begin?
It actually began when I visited the place on holiday, and I was just really moved by it and struck by it. And for a whole confluence of reasons, I guess, but it's a significant site for the people of the Yuin Nation. Mumbala Mountain was given back to the original custodians in the 1980s after a long struggle. Much later. But when I visited there, I didn't swim. The custodians preferred people not to swim, but they didn't actually say people couldn't. And there were a lot of people swimming there. And I was kind of watching this going on. And it's the most beautiful place with the mountains and just one of those places you visit and you feel something, you feel the timelessness. So that led me to imagine these two girls who might have lived in Bega, which is the nearest town, and who would have swum there because it was the place where everyone went. So that's when it started.
Well, let's talk about these two girls, Ali and Jessie. They have a really intense friendship. The two of them are on the cusp of adolescence. And this idea of friendship at that particular age is really central to the book. What is it about friendship at that age that you wanted to capture?
I think it's can have a lot of intensity at that age. Partly it's that kind of position between childhood and adulthood before. So childhood kind of calls, but so does adulthood, and it's kind of all mixed up together. But I am very interested in the intensity that particularly girls' best friends have at that age, I think, and how the best friend is almost like a complementary self, and they possess traits that you might like to have, and their families also might have glamour and allure that your own family does not have. So I guess I also think that childhood can be romanticized. I really am aware that adult emotions can exist in young people, in children as well. Well, not adult emotions, strong emotion. And so I was very interested in that. the interplay in the relationship that I remember in my own life between love and rivalry, I suppose. Mm. Yeah.
That's the pendulum does very much seem to swing between those two things. The Golden Book is set between the present day and the 1980s. The sections that are set in the past feel so real. How did you create such an evocative sense of place?
Well, I visited the area a number of times, but also just I'm someone who I kind of trace a lot of my writing back to my childhood and my childhood memories, and I have very intense and vivid kind of feelings and emotions from that time, possibly because my father died when I was 13. So it was a very intense time in my family. And also I grew up in the 1980s and we were allowed a lot of freedom at that time. I lived in the city, I didn't live in Bega, but it's almost like I brought a lot of the kind of sense of childhood freedom and sense of my own world with my best friend, and I took it to Bega, and so a lot of the emotions are kind of connected with my own life, I guess. That makes sense.
There is that real sense of nostalgia, and I think it's something that people talk about a bit, the freedoms that children had in the past. I think what's interesting about your book is alongside that nostalgia, there's this sense of doom and this escalating tension.
Mm. I didn't want it to be, I mean, yes, in part, I agree it's nostalgic, but I wanted to not romanticise it. I wanted it darker elements to be there because I think that's the other side of the coin. You know, the freedom can be great, but it potentially could have other implications as it did for these characters.
Mm. It's a wonderful book to read. It is at times a tense book to read. From the perspective of craft, is tension that something that you had thought about?
Yes, I think my editor helped with a lot with that because there were multiple time frames in the book, it was quite hard to work out the order in which to put things to maximise the tension. And I think early drafts, I didn't have that, but she helped with that. And I think this Marika Webb-Pullman at Scribe, who's been amazing, having it chronological in the present and the past, and so sort of the timelines kind of butted up against each other and each hopefully exacerbated the tension in the other, if that makes sense. All of this, yeah.
Kate, we know that the Golden Book found a home at Scribe. Can you tell us a little bit about the pathway to publication?
Oh, look, it was a bit circuitous and it took a while. I did have another publisher who were very keen, and one particular editor at a publisher, and she hung on to the manuscript for a very long time without giving a commitment, so it sort of lagged there, and then she promptly left. So that was a bit difficult.
Oh, that's crushing.
But I wasn't sorry in the end, because I think the draft, you know, the fact that it took longer, it improved. Every time I went in, I felt I'd deepened the characterization and saw and the themes, and I felt, I don't know, it deepened, and I was much happier with it than that draft that particular publisher had. So Scribe immediately snapped it up when they saw it. So, yeah, that was fantastic.
Well, that's such a nice moment. Kate, we have a lot of listeners that listen, a lot of listeners, we have a lot of writers that listen to this show. We're always on the lookout for writing advice. What is either the best or the worst writing advice that you have received?
Ooh, that I've received.
Or that you have to offer others.
I think my best reading advice, and I teach creative writing as well, and I say to my students is read as much as possible across different genres, time frames, you know, poetry, nonfiction, fiction. That's what I try to do, and that's I think that makes you a better writer. So that's my biggest advice, I think.
Well, that's a wonderful segue into our next question. Can you recommend a debut book from any time, any genre, any
I really loved Diana Reid's Love and Virtue. I thought it was an amazing book, and I was amazed by the fact that it was Diana's first book, I believe, and she's really young, and she I thought the characterization was brilliant. I thought how her multifaceted eye on the complex gender relations of this particular group of people in a university college was amazing. It was disturbing, though, because I wasn't in a university college, but I did go to university, and I felt the attitudes or the experience of young women really hadn't changed very much. It was just, the latest version. So that was disturbing. But I just thought it was really, really great.
It's such an incredible book. It blew me away as well. Kate Ryan, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Catherine. It was a real pleasure.
Hazel Edwards is an award-winning author of books for children and adults. Her beloved picture book series, There's a Hippopotamus on Our Roof Eating Cake, has been hugely popular for almost 40 years, inspiring a musical stage production and a short movie. Though that might be her best known work, Hazel has published over 220 books across a wide range of subjects and genres, including easy reading books for newly independent readers, memoir, nonfiction, including authorpreneurship, which is about the business of creativity, also writing a non-boring travel history and non-boring travel writing, bit of a theme there, plus multiple collaborations. Hazel was awarded the Australian Society of Authors Medal in 2019, has been nominated 3 times for the Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award, and was also awarded an Order of Australia Medal in 2013 for services to literature. Welcome, Hazel.
Thank you very much.
Hazel, as I said in your bio, you are best known for the beloved There's a Hippopotamus on Our Roof Eating Cake and related hippo books, but you have published so, so many more books than that. A mere 220. There's a lot of things that I want to talk to you about, but one of them is to get an understanding of how things have changed over time. And by that, I mean your creative process, how that's changed, but also your approach to the business side of being an author. Let's start with your first book. General Store was published in 1977. What did life look like when you were writing it?
Well, General Store, which I probably wouldn't use a title like that again because it was a sort of working title because it was set in a general store, was published when I was 27. What had happened was, as a teenager, I had lived in a general store in Gippsland, and the advice is always, you know, with your first book, write about what you know. So I used that setting, and that was what was autobiographical, the setting. I assumed it would be my apprenticeship novel and then I'd have to write 3 or 4 before I cracked it. I also wrote for the young adult market. It was partly a commercial decision and partly that I thought that I was teaching at that stage. The reason I had a little bit of time, or thought I'd have a little bit of time, was I was very heavily pregnant with my first daughter and thought that I would be able to control my own time for a little while and get some writing done. We all know there's a gap between the ideal and the reality.
We all have that same optimistic idea going in, don't we?
Yeah, but I have to say that baby is now my marketing manager. That's a real job somewhere else, but she fits me in and she's very helpful. So I looked at it as an apprenticeship of trying to write that length, because I'd only written shorter things before and I wasn't sure how it would go. Then I compiled a list of 10 of what were considered the best children's publishers. I started with number 1 and I decided I'd work down the list. I was lucky enough to be accepted by the first one, which was Hodder and Stoughton. And so that is why they subsequently took on the Hippo books later on, which were later moved to Penguin. But that was, it was due to the publisher, Margaret Hamilton, who had taken on that project. So one of the things that is very important for a beginning writer is to have an advocate. within a publishing house who will stand up at a publishing meeting and say, this story is worth doing. Now, I think it was to do with timing, to be quite honest. Mm. I had think that they had a gap in their list. It was set in a rural area. It was about the friendship between two different types of girls. It had an authentic background. Ironically, that's now been picked up by the Untapped project that Melbourne University is running at present with the libraries and the ASA. There's 200 books that they're promoting as e-books and subsequently print books through all the libraries. And that one was picked up. And the reason for their choice was that it went into a Finnish translation. And at that time, there weren't many books going into Finnish. I was absolutely astounded when it went into Finnish, when this book arrived with all these little wiggles on it, and I thought, I can't read that. I think I've seen that book somewhere before. Oh, it's mine. But, of course, the title was changed and so on. You asked me what was different. It was less common to be an author then. I'd written a number of journalistic articles. I had a teaching background. I was actually a teacher's college lecturer in English, but I always knew that I wanted to be an author. But I was also realistic that our family had to live too. And so for me, the teaching and the writing was similar in that they were to do with ideas, and they were to do with sharing ideas or idea mongering, if you like. And I thought a combination of that, which is why I've ended up with more mentoring recently, is because I enjoy the learning in new areas, but I also enjoy the sharing, the crafting of the sharing of it. And so that was why I was in that area. I was absolutely, I can remember floating along, they actually want to contract my book. I couldn't believe it and pay me some money for it. Again, it was not the way things are done now, which is predominantly self-publishing, which has a different context. At that stage, that would have been considered vanity publishing and a no-hopers way of moving. Now it is not like that at all. With digital changes, things have changed exponentially, and all sorts have needed to change with that and learn new skills. But at that stage, it was special to be an author. Hodder and Stoughton were London-based. They had an Australian area here, mainly in Sydney, and I'm in Melbourne. They were very assertive in selling the rights of the books. So it was much easier if you spent time on a quality piece of writing to actually gain more income from it in order to buy the time to write another one. Mm-hmm. At the moment, the relationships between writers and publishers, unless you're in the upper echelon of two or three people, is predominantly book by book basis. Whereas at that stage, they looked after their authors. And I was immensely privileged in that I, as my first editor, Barbara Kerr Wilson was a British icon editor, and I met her in Melbourne, and she went through what an editor does for a writer on their books. And this is my first experience. I was just very happy for to accept her suggestions. But she said an editor will do for a writer what they would do for themselves in a year's time when they can actually see it the way it is. And she said, accept editorial help, but only if they give reasons for it. And ultimately, it is your piece of work. And one of the challenges, I think, for beginning writers is they show their book to everybody in their circle and all their friends and all the rest of it. And one piece of advice contradicts the next. And they're so insecure that they change it according to whoever said what, the last conversation they had. You don't want to do that. You want to choose I have the greatest of respect for good editors, and I've been incredibly lucky. I've had some really good ones. But Barbara Kerr Wilson, to start with, had such an impact on me, and I really needed her skills. I'm format challenged. I'm just hopeless at getting paragraphs and things in order because I did advanced maths instead of typing at school, and that didn't help me when I came to be an author. So I missed out on the proper basics of typing and all that sort of thing, and I've always found it a challenge. So I was just so lucky to get that one. And the thing was that at that stage, publishers would, as a matter of course, they would look at your next project. It was almost a fait accompli, as long as it was. So they took my second young adult novel, which was called Kendall Men and Kempry Fred. At that stage, I didn't realise how important titles were, because General Store at that stage was not a good title because people thought it was a military rank. You know, not a shop in a country town. But now, with the changed attitudes towards regional areas, it's actually become topical. And that is one, I think, of the things I've noticed, particularly post-pandemic, that circumstances have changed very much in the external world, which means some books, the subject matter or the issues that they have dealt with have come into vogue. And a book might have had an average life when it first came out, but it might have a longer life. And my young adult Outback Ferals, which is set in Darwin about the threat of a pandemic, has suddenly become incredibly popular. It was written over 2 years ago, but because of the pandemic issue, it's suddenly being used very, very widely for discussions of climate change and so on. So one of the things about writing consistently as a older, I prefer the term vintage, it sounds like a wine, a vintage author, because I'm nearly 77, which means I've been writing since I was 27, which is a long time. It means that if you have written in a number of genres and in a number of subjects and you've consistently worked at it, the chances are amongst your backlist there will be some very dated books who have things like Walkmans in them, or they have technology that's dated. I had a series on orienteering, Kids Mysteries Gang, the O-Gang, because our family were orienteers, and that's dated so badly because lots of the clues related to technological devices. And these days kids just Google the answer. So, you know, it affects that. So it could be that the technology has dated, but it could be that the issue is a perennial. So something like Antarctica, and I was an Antarctic expeditioner as a writer in 2000-2001 for the Australian Antarctic Division, and a lot of the material that I did as a result of that has become even more of more interest because of the climate change issues and for different age groups and so on. So for beginning writers, they often write, as I did with General Store, about stuff they know. And I think that's good for first book. After that, I think you've got to continue to grow as a person. And that is why you need to have very broad experiences. That's why having another job as well as your writing or other interests, other skills is absolutely vital. Because the absolute death knell is what I call a misery memoir, where you've got this novel about a novelist sitting in a room not being able to write the novel about being a novelist sitting in a room writing a novel, which is not going to interest anybody. So the settings, the formats, the characterisation need to be growing with the interests of the writer. And those who stick in one groove are not, they're going to get bored. And that's partly the reason why I've written so many books. I like to keep learning things. And so I've often collaborated with other people who have technical knowledge in a particular area. And I've continued to learn, or have collaborated in a different format. I have a mystery series called Celebrant Sleuth, and the director and scriptwriter, Jeffrey Wright, and I did one on the Gan that relates to that character, who's a celebrant who solves mysteries at weddings and funerals, and this one is on the Gan. Now, I've been on the Gan several times, the train that runs from Adelaide to Darwin and back. It's sort of, and everybody makes jokes about the Orient Express, but because my part of my family live in Darwin. And in working with him, I learnt the process of the effective scripting and motivation at the same time as we were doing the content. So I think a writer absolutely needs to self-educate all the way along the way. And you cannot cover every occupation. Therefore, I find I read in an area that I'm wanting to learn about. I mean, when I did the Celebrant Sleuth, I think I interviewed 25 celebrants, and that was very interesting. And in other areas, I will go and find out the background. The book I mentioned, Outback Ferals, that is set in Darwin, my son works in Darwin in the scientific area, and so I got him to check stuff out for me, and that's why he originally came up with the threat of feral pigs. This was 10, 12 years ago. That was feasible. And he gave me the facts of that. And when we did the Gan story, we went and checked the measurements, how the doors open at different times, where the train was going to be, because all the locals know that. And if you get anything wrong, they know. So what I'm suggesting that as a professional author, you have to check your facts, you have to do your homework, but you have to be genuinely interested in the subject, because you're going to be living with it in your head for quite a while. So although I'm known predominantly for the hippos, and I still live in the same house that had the roof that leaked when my four-year-old thought the hippo was on the roof eating cake, and there's been a great pleasure from that. But that book belongs to the reader, not to me, right? It belongs to the reader's imaginations. And now I think there's three generations who are writing to me about it. And the hippo was 40 last year. And that's quite old for a book.
It's a massive achievement that to maintain something as so beloved across that period of time. Hey, yeah. So you've spoken a little bit about that sort of accounts for the breadth of your work. The various form it takes and the content. You mentioned that publishing has changed a lot from this very relationship-based sort of industry to how it is now. I'm interested now, when you have an idea for a book or a creative something, do you test the market kind of possibilities of the idea first? Do you still have a relationship with a publisher? I'm wondering how the creation of these things begins, because it's not only the fact that you've written 220 books. These 220 books have been published. They've found audiences.
I've made a living from being an author across that time. I've done some lecturing as well and talks and so on, but I probably would have the income comparable to a teacher, right? And that's been hard won, because there's been a lot of work to get that. But in answer to your earlier question, the ways in which things have changed and the marketing, yes, most definitely. I would check to see, especially because I read fairly widely, I get interested in social issues a bit ahead of the book market. And so, for example, when Ryan Kennedy and I did the F2M, The Boy Within, which was the first young adult novel, which I think was a very significant book about transitioning gender, which is very political at the moment. But when we started, there was a lot of resistance to that. He was a family friend, or is a family friend, whom I'd known since a child and was a comparable age to my children. And he wanted to write it with me. And so we knew that that would be very difficult to place because of subject matter. And I pay credit to Ford Street Publishing, I have multiple publishers, some partly because I do write a lot and in different fields, most of them wouldn't touch it because of the subject matter. And I pay Ford Street and Paul, who runs Ford Street, credit that he punted on that. And he knew that we would work together to get it out. And it was a challenge. It was the first young adult novel on transitioning gender, female to male, that was published. It was picked up internationally. The challenge in that area is the vocabulary changes so quickly. And so a term like F2M, which at that stage was the appropriate term, is no longer appropriate. Ryan Kennedy, with another trans man, is just finishing a comic graphic novel. They're in New Zealand, based or inspired by that, adapted from, with everybody's blessing. And that's, in this case, it's the two trans men. I've stepped back because I think it's their story to do. And that should be out, hopefully in the next year. But that's, again, using a different format, but the language has been adjusted to current language. So that was a challenging subject. So quite often I've chosen subjects that others in recent years that others have considered may not be commercially viable because nobody's interested, or nobody's interested because they haven't heard about whatever it was. Mm. And so that's made it difficult. We've had challenges with the Hijabi Girl book series too. I happen to believe that an author who is a professional will research properly, respect whatever the other culture is. I mean, I've had to research Aussie rules football so that our Melek character in Hijabi Girl, because I don't follow football.
I should say Hijabi Girl is a collaboration with
Alkin, who is a Muslim librarian who wears a hijab. It was her initial suggestion. I said, do it yourself. It's your culture. You do it. But she wanted me to do it with her, illustrated by Serena Geddes. Now, through my contacts, Larrikin Puppeteers are performing a musical with fabulous catchy songs that go, what do you call them, earworms when they stay in your head, is
yes.
that right?
Yeah, yes.
Earworm songs for junior primary, and that's being premiered in Brisbane in Children's Book Week at the end of August. And that's been a long road with that one because of attitudes and news coverage and so on. I'm not Muslim, but I respect, and I'm not trans, although some people thought I was when the F2M book came out. But it is important to craft stories so that many cultures can see themselves in those books. And one of the best ways of doing it is by collaboration between an experienced writer and someone who perhaps has the cultural knowledge of whatever the area is. And I think at the moment that this term cultural appropriation is thrown around, but if you say a person may only write about their own culture, they can write one book. And if you're a professional writer, you're going to operate in many fields, but you will do it with respect and check that things are accurate and so on. So in Hijabi Girl, for example, Erskase checked the length of our character's clothing to make sure it's appropriate. I now know about this fantastic swimsuit the girls can wear that's acceptable, the food, it's halal food and so on. But in the past I've done that too, and I did a book earlier called So Who's a Misfit, which is now called Misfit and is an ebook about a girl in an Orthodox Jewish school who is not Jewish, right? That's a reverse of what you would normally get. Now in our household, we're not Jewish, but our children went to a Jewish school for a while. So I was a little apprehensive about how that book would be taken, and it was picked up with great enthusiasm because nobody had tried that angle before, provided a totally different perspective. So for me, I think one of the values as a writer, one of the things that probably drives me is writing about coping successfully with being different in some way or that others perceive as different. And I think that in general that it can't be propaganda, though, and that's the problem. Often with the social issues, it can flip over into propaganda, which is saying, my point of view is right, I can't tolerate yours, I'm a minority, therefore you must agree with what I say. Now, I don't think that's fair either. I think there is room to understand, to immerse yourself in another character's world where the culture is part of the background. If the story doesn't work as a story, nobody's going to read it. So it's got to be crafted as an enjoyable story. So Our Hijabi Girl is a group, a very disparate group, fun group, of eight-year-olds in a mainstream school, one of whom is Vietnamese and fabulous at drawing things, which is a cultural value in the Vietnamese community. I live in a community here in Melbourne that has many Vietnamese families, and I know how important the drawing is. We have Zach, who plays football, plays soccer, which is different from Aussie rules football. We have another character, Lily, who's interested in how things look. It's very different. So our Melek in a hijab is not the only character in that story, right? And our school is pretty typical of a lot of schools in Melbourne these days who are very multicultural. My 12-year-old grandson goes to a very multicultural state school. They will get along fine.
The collaborations that you've just mentioned, F2M yes. and Hijabi Girl, I think are really interesting examples of collaboration. In terms of how they worked, what were some of the practicalities? What makes collaboration easier?
Well, one of the things with the improvements in technology is that it doesn't matter where your collaborator lives. I wrote much of F2M while Ryan was he's in New Zealand now, but he used to be in Melbourne. So we did it on Skype, really, every Sunday. And I had to learn the technology to cope with that. Erskine lives a 1.25+ hour drive away from me. We have had things going backwards and forwards on email and so forth. With some of my other collaborations, such as with Dr. Helen McGrath when we wrote the Adult Difficult Personalities book, which is probably one of the most popular of my other our other titles, that's gone into Polish, Russian, Korean, Chinese, just going to Vietnamese with an amazing cover, American, Canadian, etc.
Difficult personalities all over the world.
Well, somebody said to me, does that mean the cultures that have bought it have got difficult personalities? I said, I don't know, I wouldn't say anything like that. But it's a book of strategies. We did that differently in that Helen was a psychologist and we'd been in teachers' college together, but I wrote, my part was making it accessible. It wasn't that I wrote her notes and we did it together. So sometimes with a big book like that, which took 4 years to write, you really need a concentrated period where you can shut yourselves up in a house somewhere, a long way from anybody else, have some nice food and just go over the whole thing and pull it together at the end. In between, I often use what I call a cappuccino approach, and that is you meet for a coffee in a cafe somewhere if it's not pandemic, and you know you've got to see them then, so you know you're going to get your share done by the time. So overcoming procrastination, that is one of the important factors with co-writers too. I think a co-writer needs to be somebody who writes at who is on the same ethical wavelength as you are and works in a comparable way, but may have different skills or may have different knowledge. And the combination of the two is better than working alone. The difficulty is that sometimes over a long project, people and you, I strongly suggest that you have a contract such as the ASA's one about co-writing. Always work on a contract, and preferably 50-50, right? Even if you think one is doing more than the other, it's much better to do that. But you'll find that you can't remember exactly who thought of what, because you've taken over those ideas as part of your development. And that sometimes becomes a problem where a more experienced writer will, in a sense, mentor the other, who then feels that they've got all that knowledge, but they mightn't have had all that experience as well. So it's a very delicate, I think it's probably a bit like marriages, really, in relation and romantic relationships. You know, it might work well for one period, but it may not go on. But in general, I think it is a very good way. And often, too, the more experienced writer may have more business knowledge and be able to get a contract, in answer to your original question about the marketing and so on. I think it is very difficult, it is more difficult to co-write fiction than it is non-fiction. Non-fiction, you can have a table of contents and work it all out. With fiction, one of the ways is to adopt a character each. So you'll find that there are some co-written books that are sort of alternate chapters, like, and that's partly because it is quite difficult to cover the nuances. And the other problem that arises is if somebody writes in the formal language of their psychologists who use extreme psychological terms, or engineers who use the engineering terms, and you're writing for a general reader, and even the length of the sentences and the words you use, making that accessible is a real skill, and very important.
Have you had, in these co-writing experiences, times when it just hasn't worked? Or challenges in having different points of view? How do you negotiate?
Mainly they've worked out and the project's finished. There's been a bit of angst at sometimes. I think the time when it becomes most difficult is when the book's highly financially successful and one wants to move into adaptations in a different field and the other one doesn't. Or maybe if it is a collaboration between an illustrator and a writer on a picture book, in that case, the writer controls the text and the illustrator controls the visuals. And if you want to move into film or into Disney or into something else, that is all dependent on all agreeing, and sometimes those things don't happen. So if the book is very successful, or alternatively, if the process is dragged out so long that it's just not feasible. Now, what happens sometimes is someone for whom writing is their full-time occupation and the other person has expertise in a field that needs to be added to that book, they will put their day job first, understandably. But the full-time writer will probably need to have multiple projects running at the same time, because it's just not feasible to sit around waiting or to end up doing more than 50%. So all those things need to be sorted out beforehand. So I would say for beginning writers, quite often they think, oh, my friend can draw the pictures, or my friend can do such and such. That could be heading for the end of a friendship unless you sort it out in the beginning and say, well, look, we are going to have a contract because the author, Australian Society of Authors, suggests that it's a good move. And so in all of our cases, we've done that.
The contract is as much about forcing the discussion too, isn't it? In many cases.
And it's the issue of deadlines, quite frankly. At the moment, it's a very difficult market. The number of publishers have shrunk. There are some smaller publishers who are very active and energetic, and that's terrific, but still they're one book projects in most cases. So you have to look at how you spend your time. If you're going to be a writer, if you've got a full-time other job and you've got a family, maybe you've got lots of demands. I mean, I had two children while I was writing in the beginning. I've got four grandchildren who range from 23 to 1 at the moment. The 23-year-old's writing his own novel, 120,000 words in. I had a supportive family in that I had a husband who was my accountant, which was very useful. No, genuinely, that was helpful because many writers are notoriously bad at doing the paperwork. And so the business side, and they don't see themselves as a business, but in fact they are a small business of one. And that one has to do the accounts as well as writing the great Australian novel or whatever else it is that you're doing. There's also a need to diversify in perhaps in genres that you write in, or that a story may fit a different format, because the Australian market is too small. You need an international market. And these days you need other formats. I think there will be even greater increase in audiobooks now. Many people used audio during the lockdowns for obvious reasons and exercise and so on. But unfortunately, from the creator's perspective, there's no recompense for that if it's borrowed from a library at the moment. So there's no digital lending rights. So something like educational lending rights and public lending rights, which the ASA organised initially, and I must speak up for being professional and belonging to organisations like the Writers' Centre and Australian Society of Authors or the Writers, whatever's appropriate, Society of Women Writers as well is increasing. I'm the patron of that. Also, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators is very prominent in helping with the marketing for beginning writers. So all of those, you need to be aware of them, but there's no digital lending rights nor on ebooks. And so they were the two, the ebooks and the audio, that were predominantly used during the pandemic, and yet there was no return to those who'd put their work into it. So PLR, which is a public lending right for books borrowed in libraries surveyed, public library, and ELR is from various rights in tertiary organisations and secondary and so on. The reason I know about it was I was on the board of the Australian Society of Authors for about 20 years, and I'm not a committee person, but I felt it was necessary that a working writer, a full-time working writer, would speak up about the things that mattered. And so for many, for example, of the children's authors, and you're more likely to make a living as an author if you're a children's author or you're a genre writer, mystery writing, science, fantasy, historical, etc., because you've got a targeted market, but you've also, until recently, like lockdowns and pandemics, had a speaking circuit. And so many of the children's authors and illustrators, the talking circuit was a way of both selling their books, exposure, growing their audiences, and they could, the hardworking ones, could make a living from that. So that's part of the business side of being a writer, and you do need to take care of that as well as writing the original stuff. And so I think it's probably very rare that a writer would sit down and actually work out what percentage of their time they spent on what I call administrivia, which I'm finding is increasing, and what percentage they spend on original writing, what percentage actually get published, what when people begin writing, they're just thrilled to bits to get published. And there is nothing like the smell of your new book. You know, you should smell it. You know, it's a very good experience. But then you've got to think, well, it's got to sell enough to be viable for all the amount of time you put into it. So I think you have to be realistic about what you want to write. I think you have to be genuinely engaged with what you're interested in writing. I think you've had Gabrielle Wong on your
we have recently. I'm hoping to raise Gabrielle Wong, actually. You mentioned mentoring before in our recent interview with her. She cited you as a mentor and someone who'd really
she's one
you.
Of my hazelnuts. That's what they call this is a self-given name. I didn't give it to them. They're people I've mentored to, and they're published. And Gabrielle, her first book I thought was stunning, but she came to me when I was teaching a night class at Holmes Glen on writing, and she was already an established illustrator. What she wanted was help with the writing. And her first book, which was fairly the Empress one, that's my favourite one of hers.
The Empress Cassius, is it?
Yes, yeah, Empress Cassius. It had a few other titles I have trouble keeping up with. But she definitely had something to say, and that's a beautifully written work. But she came at it from the illustrator's point of view, crossing over, so that now she has both skills and she's a hazelnut. And her mother was the most magnificent Chinese cook, and she only taught certain people she approved of cooking skills. Anyway, she took on my husband, who used to do the cooking here, and she talked about it, and she took him wok shopping. And as a result, he has a string of Chinese recipes, which we totally credit to Gabrielle Wong's family.
Oh, what a wonderful
and
story.
I think Gabrielle calls it. But there are other people who are hazelnuts too, and they're usually people who've done the year-long courses. I run one at the Public Records Office for people who want to complete, because procrastination's the hardest thing to overcome, who want to complete either their family history or a non-fiction work. I've had somebody writing about midwives. I've got a number of surgeons who are writing about their lives at the moment. Very, very varied. When they're published, which of course takes a year or so, they often call themselves my hazelnuts.
It's lovely. I mean, mentoring is something that you've clearly done a lot of and do well. What does good mentoring look like?
Asking the right questions. I operate on the Socratic method. That is, I keep asking questions till they work out their own solutions. I started, and there's a difference between voluntary mentoring, where you're involved, and professional mentoring, which is what I sort of tend to do in my writing workshops, and I follow on with my people after it's finished. But originally I came to mentoring mainly because I was involved with the Gifted Children's Organisation, and they would match particular children to me over a long period of time, and so I had a number of them. And then, I mean, there are many, many people looking for mentors, but I'm very particular in who I actually take on professionally. There are organisations such as the Writers' Centre and the ASA and so on who have mentoring programs, and I would strongly suggest that if you're a beginning writer, you try and get into these, that you the benefit is someone's genuinely interested in what you're writing, and you're accountable to them every time you meet them. And that is also the benefit of being in a regular writing group who are at your standard. That's the important thing. It doesn't matter what the standard is, but they're roughly at your standard. They can encourage you and take an interest in your book baby becomes their sort of stepchild book baby, and they follow that through. And that is what enables many people to finish. And so with the lockdown and the pandemic, I had to go online with my existing workshop class, and that was a very interesting experience. The ones who'd met each other in person at the beginning, before we moved into lockdown, who then went online with me they were much more supportive of each other's work.
Mm.
The group that only met online were not as closely linked. And so I think there are difficulties with online mentoring, but it's better than not doing it at all. And then I have a group of males who in their 70s who knew each other beforehand and who trust each other and who trust me, that's why I'm not going to be too specific about them, to write. They're mainly had very productive lives, very charitably involved, highly skilled, but they're wanting to leave something for their children because they all had migrant backgrounds and they feel that their children's, adult children's lives are very different from what they experienced. So they're trying to write genuinely about what really mattered. And they trust each other. And that's been a very productive group, but they knew each other before.
Mm, so interesting. Hazel, you have given us a lot of great advice already. We have a lot of writers that listen to this show. While I have you here, I may as well press you for one more piece.
Yes,
what do you think is the best or the worst advice you have remaining for emerging or early career writers?
I think you have to be persistent, honestly. You have to keep working at it. I think there's a bit of a danger for people to play the writer and the writerly life and run around and do lots of things. But ultimately, and also get seduced by an overdose of social media, but ultimately you actually have to write and you have to do it regularly. And you have to keep to either your or other people's deadlines. That's absolutely vital. And so slowly you will get there. Sometimes it is very difficult because you get knockbacks, not because of the quality of your work necessarily. It might be the wrong length. It might be the wrong time. They've got something like that already, etc. But it still hurts, you know? So that is where you need one or two professional friends with whom you can share both the successes, because other people are not interested either, both the successes when you've achieved something you didn't think you would, but also also when things go, it's more when things go wrong. Because if you're genuinely trying to do something of quality and it's not working, and you might be a bit ahead of the interests of the publishing world. The other is to possibly look at outside conventional books. Your story might work quite well in other formats. I am thrilled with this puppeteering.
And we will link to this in show notes because it is coming up.
Yeah, I would say that's been the most creatively satisfying, the caliber of the puppets, etc. But this couple who are ethically admirable, who've had all sorts of things going on and they just keep going, and it's a fantastic performance. And my grandchildren are flying, two of the little grandsons flying across from Darwin to Brisbane to see this when it premieres, and the one in Melbourne's flying up as well, because he's the only one who saw the hippo performances in Melbourne, because it's part of a very important imaginative development. And it's so important for our society that intellectual property be valued, not just bricks and mortar. Intellectual property really matters, and it has economic implications for our society too, because unless the really good arts practitioners like Larrikin puppets are supported, and they will tour nationally and they'll probably do it overseas afterwards, but unless they're supported, we lose those experiences for our young people who may not go on to write books. They may go on to build bridges or invent other things, but unless we nurture those creative risk-taking, we're going to lose out as a community.
That's a great point. I had actually read a quote that you had said that echoed a sentiment that another guest on our show, Tony Birch, had sort of said, which was about investing in support rather than recognition of writers, which I think
is great. And I think some people get so worried about the self-promo Twitters that are around, which bear not much resemblance to real life. I find it frustrating at times for the sort of put downs, as if you're doing something creative, it's of less value than other things. Now, I have academic qualifications too, but they're not all relevant to these projects. What is relevant is actually putting a book or putting a child on a seat in a theatre who, or an adult too, who has an experience that enables them to see the world with a bit more tolerance. That's of more value.
It's a nice note to nearly end on. Hazel, the very final question, we normally finish with a debut book recommendation. You said you would prefer to recommend some writers instead.
I genuinely would, because, I mean, I read a lot. I'm a readaholic. I read in the bath, but don't tell the librarians that. I don't read the electronic books in the bath because I don't want to fuse.
You can now. I just bought a Kobo that is waterproof for exactly
really?
That.
Really?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, well, I've learned something today. Thank you. I'll find out about that. Okay, now there's two Australian writers I'd like to recommend. One, and I can give you the links to them afterwards. You just Google. One is Cheryl Clarke. Cheryl Clarke is a very well-crafted writer. I think she's fantastic. She has written a number in the children's area, young adult, but what I think she's really good at and is concentrating on the moment is adult mysteries with local settings. I don't know anybody else who's had a crime story out of Ascot Vale in Melbourne that kept my interest. She's really good. She's moved to New Zealand at the moment. I tend to group Australian and New Zealand writers together. I'll give you the link for her. Anything of hers is very, very well put together. And the other one is Sophie Masson. I'd like to recommend anything that Sophie Masson is involved in. Most recently, I don't know if I can do this one, she's produced the inside story on the world of writing, illustrating and publishing children's books. I'll send you the link for that too. Now, she lives in New England and she's developed, they have a publishing house there. She's run the Writers' Centre there. She speaks about six or seven languages. She writes a lot of historical fiction. She crosses over into other mediums. She really is a literary entrepreneur and she's a magnificent writer. She has a French background. She lived in Indonesia when she was a child. She's totally a total internationalist and a really nice woman who writes good quality stories. So anything by Sophie Masson, just, you know, dial her up, you'll find. She's actually Dr. Sophie Masson these days. She used to run she used to be the chair of the Australian Society of Authors. And one day an email came in about copyright issues internationally in France. It was in French. It was in legal language. She simultaneously translated it into English in words we could understand, and I was very impressed.
Oh, incredible. Great recommendations.
So those two. And can I just say very quickly, and I think I've sent it through to you, on the back of my Complete Your Book in a Year are a number of the Hazelnuts who have published their own works. And maybe we can put that link there, but I put them in part because of the range. One of them is Blindness for Beginners by Maribel Steele, who is in fact blind. Fabulous book. She put bells on her children's socks so she could find them. Hidden Disability, which is on skills. Michelle Layat's one about the Maccas, the history of working in Maccas. And Second Chinese Daughter by Shirley Fung. It's a very interesting Malaysian-based story of three generations of strong women. Lots of others on there, but they're wonderful. All very diverse. Right,
we're running out. We will absolutely link to those. Thank you, Hazel Edwards, for being on the show.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.